said the whipping master, and you hold them up to your cock, and you keep that cock up off my apron, little fellow, understand?
Yes, sir,
said the boy yet again. You see what I mean, said Alexei. You hear how he talks to them. Well, the guiding genius over there must approve of it, I said. It was igniting my blood, the tone of his voice. It's appealed to utter dependency in the slave. Oh, yes, or he would be replaced, said Alexei. And he and Eva are developing names for these types of whipping masters, and all masters and mistresses and grooms. Scolding mistresses, angry masters, comforting masters, cross mistresses, and so on. And by the way, the smallest of the punishment shops has whipping mistresses only, and some of them are a spectacle indeed. The whipping master patted the boy tenderly all over his gleaming bottom and thighs, then stripped off the glove and picked up the inevitable gold paddle, which had a pair of pretty blue ribbons streaming from its tooled handle. Now who's going to be the best possible little boy for me, he asked.
I am, sir,
said Valentine. And who's going to go back to his master and try very hard to please?
I am, sir,
came the inevitable reply. Down came the paddle with such a riff of blows I was amazed. I drew back, glancing in surprise at Alexei. The boy got 15 to 20 spanks within seconds, and they were hard, and they didn't stop. The whipping master raised his eyebrows and appeared to be singing as he spanked away, and Valentine's head was bowed, and he was soon dancing on his knees and crying completely, indeed reduced to the deepest and most complete vulnerability before our eyes. But his hands held fast to his gathered scrotum and hard cock, and though he bounced on his knees, he couldn't help it. His organ never once touched the master's apron. The rumble of voices in the place grew louder, more spirited, though no one actually turned to look, that I could see, at the poor boy. I could feel the current of excitement passing through the room, as if the paddle were a drum beating a lusty cadence. Now the boy was squirming desperately in that hopeless effort to escape the paddle, the body unable to accept what the mind knew. The loud hard spanks came slower, but the boy was woefully red. The whipping master snapped the fingers of his left hand for his groom and made a gesture I did not know. At once the groom came round and reached down for the boy's ankles, and then effortlessly hiked them high into the air. The boy's twisting and turning body pulled back and lifted off the apron, so only his chest and shoulders rested on it, and the whipping master pounded the elevated backside, whistling or singing to himself as before. How he seemed to love it! I'd never thought before about these men who did nothing day in and day out but paddle and spank. He seemed a paragon of his profession. His blue eyes positively twinkled beneath his heavy grey brows. At last he drew a breath and sat back. The boy's sobs were loud, though his lips were shut. Now, do I give the best spanking in this village, or do I not? Asked the whipping master, rubbing the boy's pretty hair with his hand. Come on, speak up, Valentine. I'm not hearing anything. I'm going to spank you again if you don't speak up.
Yes, sir,
sobbed the boy, but his voice was low and restrained, and had dignity to it.
The best, sir. And please, sir, spank me as you please, sir.
More paddling on the bottom, now swinging in the air. The powerful groom had no problem holding the boy's ankles, and the boy's hands never left his genitals nor tried to cover them up. His cock was red and gleaming. I could see the tip of it lathering. Oh, how I knew that desperation. I knew it now. And as if Alexei were reading my mind, as surely as Lady Eva had, he said, Are you nearly coming under those fancy Russian clothes? How about you? I asked. Just about. We must have been there an hour. Finally, it was full dark, and I'd seen 5 slaves, 3 boys and 2 girls, very efficiently and effectively spanked. One of the girls, a precious nymph with black curls, had obviously come while being spanked, but it didn't seem the great, cheerful lord of the paddle knew it. The groom certainly knew it as he saw her red face and her stuttering spasms. I saw him smile. The patrons had seen it, and they began to scold and point and shake their heads and wag their fingers. And so she was forced to make the round of the punishment shop on her knees after, the groom holding her wrists high, touching her tender little moist pelt to each boot insofar as she could squat that low, and begging pardon for her indulgence of those who scarcely took the time to wiggle her chin or tousle her curls. Many gentlemen, and even ladies, extended their boots or shoes for her to touch them with her moist sex, and patted her on the head forgivingly. I'd never been made to do this. I'd never come while being paddled in this shop. Patrons filled the little pouch hanging around her neck for another spanking. When she'd come round to us, having made a circuit of the place from left to right, I felt her succulent wet sex and kissed her upturned mouth. Bad girl, I said. Take it from a bad boy. I know. I put 2 coins in her pouch.
My lord,
she whispered with perfect manners. I felt of the sweet, firm flesh under her arms, and then pinched both her nipples. Alexei, who'd been watching all with very detached eyes, beckoned for her to be brought round to him. Lift her, he said. The groom did this so that her hips were right in front of him. Now offer me your ripe little plum, girl, he said. She pushed her pelvis forward as best she could, fresh tears springing to her eyes. He spanked her pubis hard with his flat fingers over and over. Bad, bad, bad girl, he said in a low, scornful voice. Do you know the meaning of the word perfection?
I'm so sorry, my lord,
she said, her lips quivering, her wet cheeks glistening in the candlelight. I observed all this with a little surprise, but I said nothing. He slipped coins into her little purse for more spanking. You tell the whipping master to spank her until she exhibits complete control, he told the handler. And off she was taken to be put in the line and spanked once more. Maybe only once more. It was then that Prince Richard saw us and joined us, and he chatted with Alexei as though he could afford to have a little relief from his vigilance. He remembered me. Prince Dmitri, he said, you don't know how I envied you, that you knew the Sultanate before it was destroyed. Yes, that was an education, Prince, I said. But this is our world, and frankly, I find it now infinitely superior. I suspect whatever we learned in the Sultanate will blossom in this realm, under a brighter, more loving sun than ever we knew there. I thought of Lexius. I thought of many things. He smiled at me. Dmitri, you are as I remembered you, he said, always so filled with philosophy. I'd call it poetry, said Alexei with a little grin. Ah, it's all talk, I confessed. We learn things in the Sultanate, true, but in a way everything that truly shaped my soul had occurred here. Yes, I know what you mean, Richard answered. Well, you have chosen the most glorious time for your return. That is undoubtedly true, I said. It was full dark when the three of us went out, as Prince Richard wanted to be at court tonight, and lived at the castle besides, and Alexei invited him to return with us. We walked through the village together. It was filled with light. Torches, lighted windows, candle-lighted shops open for late visitors, and lanterns hung outside doors. Lots of gaily painted paddles and straps for sale, along with myriad other toys. Lots of slaves on display. Herms, indeed. I saw one splendid damsel with a silver phallus rising between her legs. Alexei pointed out it was a new fashion, the double phallus, one half well anchored in the girl, the other half displayed in manly fashion. There were many such new toys for sale in the shop behind her. It can be strapped on tight if she's meant to use it to penetrate a young piglet in the rear, said Prince Richard. Lady Eva designed it. Prince Alexei said that Eva was brilliant. I'll come down later after all the festivities, Richard explained to me. Should you want to join me, you're welcome. The crowd's a bit more rowdy, and the late-night whipping mistress is a marvel. She's a different story from the loving old father you just witnessed. This set my cock to stirring again, but then so had the double phallus. Thin, pointed features, but hands made of living marble, Richard continued, describing the late-night whipping mistress. She wears an old-fashioned wimple over her hair and is immaculate and severe in attire. A child's nurse from the underworld, said Alexei breezily, where Sisyphus struggles forever to move his boulder up the hill. Richard laughed. She is a great believer in her own doer methods, he said scornfully. She puts me in mind of old Lord Gregory, said Alexei. He is still with us, Dmitri, and the same. Always angry, always in a state of indignation, always believing that a slave is beyond hope. Yes, said Richard. She's cut from that very cloth. She offers vicious indignation and horror to each little piglet and partridge at their disobedience, and even those sent merely for their weekly maintenance hear her imprecations and ominous warnings against being lazy and disrespectful and utterly lost. I'd never known a whipping mistress in the village in my time. Oh, the women of the village whipped their slaves hard enough, but women had not worked in these places then. When we reached the gate, I expected to see all the king's ponies refreshed, but this was an entire new team, except for Caspian and Bastian in the lead, and a tall, magnificent pony tethered to their far right. It was all as blindingly impressive as it had been before. I went up to have a look at that splendid new pony. That's Caesar, Prince, said a groom, the king's favorite of the moment. The pony was too tall to be well matched with the others, but likely there weren't many with whom he could be matched. He stood staring straight ahead, his back respectfully arched, and his chin high as I looked at him. He had a great mane of white blonde hair, but with some of it tied back and braided to keep it out of his face. And this pony had an extraordinary face, a high and broad and serene forehead, and beautifully etched dark eyebrows that were high placed to show off his huge blue eyes. His cheekbones were beautiful. His mouth, even with the bit in it, was clearly magnificent. I reached out tentatively towards his mouth. Oh, do examine him, said Alexei softly to me. I felt of the man's lower lip. I could see him sigh and lift his shoulders and then straighten himself, all but shivering under my touch. His gilded nipples were enormous and had been wound with adhesive paste and fine wire, and from the wire hung teardrop weights against his chest. In his navel was a gold medallion with a lion's head on it. He was one of the more nearly perfect humans I'd ever beheld. He pulls the king's small chariot, my lord, said the enthusiastic and helpful groom. He drew up and smoothed back Caesar's hair. He's the king of the stable, if you will. Aren't you, Caesar? The pony smiled, his eyes crinkling, his cheeks plumping, and I heard a low, secretive laugh come from him. The groom smacked his backside and he jumped, but only a little. His legs were like marble. He's been kept idle all day, said the groom, in case his majesty should want to ride out. So we're to work him hard tonight. And does this mean he is a paragon? I asked. He had better be, said Alexei in a droll voice. If he weren't, well, let's just say his backside and legs would be the color of burgundy wine, and his face would be so wet you would think it freshly enameled. The groom thought that was wondrously clever, and something quickened in Caesar's face, as if he too were amused, but he stood firm, as if on principle. All the while Richard observed these things with vague amusement. We returned to the chariot, the ponies straining at their harnesses and shifting their weight from foot to foot as if eager to run. Tell me, Richard, if you can. There was an old scholar in my time, I said. Well, no older then than we are now. A very cheerful and learned man. Do you remember him? Is he still in the village? He used to stroll by my old master's house. Why, of course, I recall the man. He's the bookseller and quite the connoisseur of ancient texts as well. His shop is the only one of its kind in the kingdom, and it's a bit of a library, with everyone borrowing from it now and then, and with the king sending down for books, and even donating new ones. Seems the king is as partial to books as to gold when visitors come. Ah, of course, a bookseller. Yes. And the scribe for the most demanding documents or letters, you know, as he knows all the official greetings and even some of the law. Roland is his name. Ah, that's it, I said. I remember now, Roland. I recalled him when that poor boy, Valentine, said that he spilt the ink. Did he say that? Asked Richard. Well, Valentine belongs to Roland, and Roland is hardly the strictest of masters. Likely he must write himself notes to remember to send Valentine to the punishment shop. But it's demanding work in that bookshop, and Roland makes a pretty footstool of Valentine for hours when he's writing. He paid a lot at the public sale for Valentine, as Valentine is highly educated and can read and write. Our Lady Mayor bid against him for Valentine, but lost. I smiled. Often the slaves with the most serene faces were those who knew how to read and write. Why? I had no idea. But it was time to mount the chariot and be off. The festivities would begin late, and I was tired and needed the warmth and comfort and cleansing of the bath. The long winding way back up the hill was lined with torches, and at several points I marveled to see brightly illuminated shrines, in which highly polished slaves were posed and bound in what seemed rather beautiful positions. The lanterns surrounding these niches and their human artifacts were large and glittered with multiple candle flames. "It's not as taxing as it looks," said Alexei, following my eyes. "They are mounted in those niches for no more than 3 hours each evening. They'll be relieved later on by others, and then by the stroke of midnight, they'll be packed off to bed. The King and Lady Eva are ever vigilant that every slave be well treated, and Queen Beauty would be shocked, were they not." The castle and the castle gardens were splendidly illuminated as we drove up. I could hear a great gentle buzz of voices everywhere, and the high crenellated walls of the castle were ablaze with torches as well. I kissed my companions goodbye, hurried up to my room, and fell down on the bed in a dead faint. My cock pulsed and demanded things of me. I told it to be still and fresh for the night. 6. The great red and gold canopied pavilion of the King and Queen dominated an immense garden that I didn't recognize from before, so huge was it, and filled with other smaller pavilions, fountains, and potted and natural trees. The King and Queen were feasting at a long banquet table when at last I was summoned, along with several other royal returnees, and told I might be introduced and present my gifts now. I dressed carefully for this in a lighter silken European tunic and leggings and slippers, and felt much more comfortable now in the warm, delightful breeze. The air was filled with the music of harps and horns and drums. On great polished platforms laid down on the grass, lords and ladies danced with stately precision, and a long carpet ran up to the platform before the King and Queen. King Laurent looked larger than life in his brilliant scarlet velvet and gold tunic and long, full-bordered sleeves, and the Queen was a vision of delicacy and enticing loveliness, suggestive of lilies, with her pale skin, golden hair, and girlish eyes. To either side, well-dressed members of the court dined with them, the table seeming to go forever out of sight. I knew some of these faces even from a distance, and thought I glimpsed old Lord Gregory there, bending over his plate rather moodily with heavy brows. And if I wasn't mistaken, the severe cold-eyed woman looking back at me sharply from the Queen's left was Lady Elvira, who had once been the harsh, merciless mistress of the king. There were others far too numerous for me to note. Everywhere I beheld costly attire, jewels on throats and fingers and wrists, and shimmering veils of the sheerest silk, and the glitter of silver and gold plate. The many tables all around me and before me were strewn with fresh flowers. The scent of gardenias and lilies was intoxicating. Potted rose trees bloomed everywhere I looked, it seemed, and pathways had been made through the maze of the garden by fine India carpets, trodden underfoot now as carelessly as the grass. Naked slaves, exquisitely coiffed and groomed, and some even decorated with leafy chains of little flowers laid over their hips, served wine and steaming hot platters of food to the royal guests and to a wilderness of other banqueting nobility and gentlefolk in pavilions or at open tables everywhere I looked. Behind the King and Queen, naked slaves stood on a low wall, still as statues, legs wide apart, oiled genitals gleaming, garlanded heads bowed. Man, woman, man, woman. Arms raised, hands clasped behind the neck. To the far right as I approached, I saw slaves running on the familiar bridle path where I'd been such a failure in my time, falling down and then crawling away from the mounted lord who sought to drive me with his paddle. Such a disgrace. The slaves I glimpsed ran fast and with grace, knees high, booted feet striking the earth gracefully. But I realized quite suddenly that the mounted figures driving them were not mounted on horses at all. Each was in a small light chariot, like an ancient battle chariot, pulled by a male pony. I wanted to see more of this, and knew that later I would. I could see companion slaves everywhere at the feet of those they served, sitting back on their heels, waiting for the slightest command, and some being made to play fetch with a flowering branch or a bright golden ball. There were fountains surrounded by naked slaves on their knees, facing out, with their arms bound to the rim of the fountain, and in the center of these busy, sparkling pools of water stood other slaves about the high pillar that held the smaller second basin with its splashing spout. Now all this took me back to the Sultanate, where every night, it seemed, I'd been in a lighted garden, playing at games of fetch, or adorning some fountain, superbly taught by my dark-faced and delicate-fingered masters, none of whom spoke our tongue, but managed to convey their wishes to us effortlessly with their firm hands. Only Lexius had spoken our tongue, and he'd been taken away by Laurent and the captain shortly after we'd been brought there. Surely the Sultan's influence was alive, here in this endless paradise of sweetly illuminated trees with its countless guests. I saw slaves as footstools, and kneeling as pets beside their masters and mistresses, and then the spectacle of X crosses, to which spread-eagled slaves were bound with shining silver and gold cuffs at ankles and uplifted wrists, heads held in place with stately collars, and often crowned with flowers, genitals decorated in gold. Here and there leashed slaves were being driven as puppies through the festive crowds, their necks collared, their heads bound. Inevitably, some were prodded about by a phallus driven into the anus at the end of a handsome, tooled leather rod. How I recall the feel of that phallus, and the way one was prodded forward by the rod or wand. I saw a stately young noblewoman standing idly beneath a tree, strung with flickering lanterns, making her little boy kneel up and beg for the sweets she dangled over his head, with his hands bound behind his back. Slave cocks were everywhere erect, bottoms red, faces modest and submissive. The serving slaves, with the pretty fluttering flower chains around their hips, looked more naked than all the rest. I found myself in a short line of others waiting for my audience. Fabian stood beside me with my gifts. I think he had become more used to things by this time, perhaps with memories of India and Lexius returning to him, but he was devouring what he saw. I'd added to my gifts since my visit to the village several antique volumes of history in Greek and in Latin, and a book of old Roman poetry especially for my lord, the king. These I'd brought with me for my own sometime pleasure, but was now delighted to offer them to Laurent. At last, my name was announced. I stepped forward before the long banquet table and bowed. "Prince Dimitri, we welcome you to the kingdom," said the sweet-faced and generous queen, as if we hadn't met earlier that day. She was outfitted entirely in blue, blue that matched her peerless eyes, and her thin white veil barely concealed her magnificent hair. The king stood and put out his arms to me, his face filled with warmth and good cheer, and we embraced over the litter of meats and fruits and platters of sweets, and then I stepped back, smiling at both of them, and telling them from my heart how happy I was to be here, and how I hoped to remain. This is usually where I dip my long, full sleeves into a plate of sauce and despise myself for it, but this time I did not. Fabian stepped forward at my summons, and I opened the first casket and presented my gracious hosts with the gold and silver vessels I'd brought from the Russian lands. "These came from old Constantinople in my grandfather's time," I said with muted pride, "for your majesties, with all my heart." Then came the casket of gold, equivalent to the collective dowries of all my sisters and female cousins, and the king nodded gratefully with the seemingly very sincere words that I was too kind. Other gifts followed, candlesticks and plate, a necklace of Indian diamonds for the queen, emerald brooches, and finally the books and the book of poetry which I gave to the king with my own hands. "The Latin poem of Propertius, my lord," I said. "Ah, but I shall treasure this, prince," he said, "and will you remain with us? We are so hoping that you have made your decision to stay." "My lord," said the queen, "Prince Dimitri will be living in a fine townhouse adjacent to the place of public punishment. Lady Eva has arranged it all." The queen nodded to her left, and for the first time I saw Lady Eva there, her hair pinned up and back, and studded with pearls and diamonds and ivory combs. How grand she looked, how truly regal, and I had treated her so casually. I was ashamed. After I kissed the Queen's hand, I took Lady Eva's hand. "Ah, Prince, I do hope you'll be pleased," she said to me. "Your house is ready for you tonight, if you so choose, though it's our hope you'll feast late with us, and go tomorrow at your leisure. It's your choice." She was indeed high in favour here, and had a self-possession well beyond her years. A sweet-faced naked boy stood behind her chair, arms pulled back as if they were folded against his back. I could see his cock was about half-hard, which is the usual thing during long banquets, but his pubic hair was decorated with small flowers, and so was the full blonde hair of his head. His nipples had been gilded, but apparently with a paste of gold, because small bells hung from them on delicate, shimmering threads. I could feel this when I looked at it, feel the paste on my own nipples, feel the bells against my chest. Soon I realized that was true of almost all the slaves. Nipples were tinted with paste, and many decorated with flowers and bells, and this fine stripling dared not raise his eyes to me as the lady spoke. "What's your pleasure now, Prince?" asked another voice. It was Alexei at my elbow, in fresh garments with an exotic Eastern embroidery. "I'm here," he said, "to take you wherever you might like to go." His hair was clean and lustrous, and in his deep grey velvet he looked more impressive. "Might I have some wine near to the bridal path, your majesties?" I asked, "and watch the slaves being run there." "Of course, anything I wished," said a clamour of voices, and soon, tired and dazed as I was, I found myself seated at a small table right at the edge of the bridal path, beneath the limbs of a great old tree that was strung with lanterns, and with torches on both sides of the path burning brightly to illuminate the figures flying by. There were guests on raised platforms on the far side of the bridal path, and they seemed to go on forever. The scope of this was weakening me all over, and lulling me into a gorgeous sense of safety and peace. Never in the days of Queen Eleanor had I seen such scope and grandeur. The kingdom seemed invincible in its splendor, as if it had always been what it was on this night. Fabian rested against the bark of the tree. He looked as amazed as I was. He couldn't keep his eyes off the voluptuous slaves who drifted past, setting sweets out for me and refilling my goblet, or the twitching and undulating slave bound to the X cross nearby. Whether this was special punishment or mere adornment, I didn't know, but I saw this slave had been rubbed and burnished with gold-pigmented oil. He was a powerfully built male. In fact, he put me in mind of Laurent. He was so sturdy, and he dozed on the X cross, his head held upright by a beautifully embossed collar of blue and silver and gold. But he never stopped his subtle, twisting movements. His hair was strewn with flower petals and tiny flowers, like those that grow wild in the grass. Flowers were bound up with his scrotum and balls as well. There came one of those moments when I could do no more than absorb all that I was seeing and had seen. My mind was empty of words. But the bridal path I had not even begun to observe. I drank another gulp of wine. It was tart, but delicious. I looked at the goblet. It was fitted with jewels the size of those I wore on my fingers. I smiled to think I was part of the spectacle in my finest dress, and with rings on my hands, and emeralds studding the border of my tunic, as much a part of it as the bound slaves. I turned my full attention to one slave after another, running past on the bridal path, trying to keep pace with the lord or lady in the pony chariot beside him, or her, who whacked away hard with the great paddle, laughing and urging the slave on. Soon several girls in a row came running by, seeming as fast as men, though they never were really as fast as the men at all, and again came the flashing pageant of the masters and mistresses in their little enameled chariots, and the ponies, male all, in delicate but gleaming red and gold harnesses, bells jingling, running as fast, apparently, as they could. It seemed to me the labouring ponies were not really ornamented for the occasion, but merely hard at work, though each wore a streaming horsetail out of his anus, and some even had flowers fixed to these tails. But it was the enamelled and embossed chariots, the lords and ladies, and the helpless running slaves who were the magnet of attention. how terrified many of them appeared. I wondered if, for any, it was their first time. Fitted into the boots, with wrists laced tight behind their necks, told to run as fast as they could. The ponies certainly had the advantage over the poor slaves being spanked along, as the ponies had muscular legs and, no doubt, strong lungs. And these poor beauties were being driven, quite literally, to distraction, to keep up. I'd never made it, even once around the old circuit, before I'd fallen down and tried to get away. I'd ended every attempt, hung upside down by my ankles for half an hour, while being whipped hard by a stinging leather thrash. And then there had been so many other punishments. Crawling on my belly with back arched, so that my balls and cock were off the ground, behind the strolling queen, with the bit in my mouth, tethered to her heel, and the red X painted on my back, which meant, "Bad boy." Oh, the scorn. That I could bear. A hot memory came back to me of those long crawling journeys, when my anus was stuffed with a plug of flowers, which the queen thought so amusing, and my mouth sometimes was distorted by thick metal bits with bells on the ends. I could feel the plug in my anus now. I could positively feel the grass beneath me, and the queen's cold voice. "Come along, Dimitri. Don't make me any angrier than I already am." I studied the moving figures before me. I wondered how Barbara and Valentine had been chosen for the village rather than the court, now that slaves were given duties suited to them. And I did not see slaves here any more beautiful than either Valentine or Barbara, or the little black-haired bad girl from the punishment shop. Just thinking of any one of them was too much. I sat back, sleepy, and almost in a dream. When would I have time and privacy to enjoy a slave of my very own? I had no thought of ever leaving here. I could see to my right and left gentlemen coarsely enjoying their slaves at their tables, though ladies did not indulge themselves in the same crude way. A proud young lord had forced his slave to stand bent over for mounting with the slave's forehead and hands on the ground. That was common enough. He pounded away at the slave with complete abandon, ripping his cock out of the slave's backside when he was finished and shoving it back in his clothes. With a pat or two, he dismissed the slave, who scampered on his hands and knees, though to where, I did not know. Grooms were everywhere, it was true. No doubt they did keep watch on each and every naked little personage. And now I saw a groom approach the magnificent male, tethered to the cross, and give him a few sips of wine. With his head up, the poor boy couldn't lap it, so he was allowed to sip it. Then the groom tormented his immense cock to make it stand up in its lacings, and then he moved on. Though noble women would not make spectacles of themselves as the lords here, with their ever-ready cocks, obviously many were slipping away, and I realized there were handsome little tents scattered about, with fringed roofs and billowing flags. Perhaps in those, noble women coupled with the slaves of their choice, or offered their privy parts for pleasuring. The whole garden was busy. Bands of musicians clad in pied garments were strolling through the sea of tables and gaily dressed people. I heard the low nasal melody of horns, the soft throb of flutes, and heard the soft crash of cymbals. Now and then a sprightly drummer appeared, beating the two little drums affixed to his belt as he danced and turned artful circles. My cock was hard, but I was so tired. It had a life the rest of me did not possess. My brain was warring with my cock. All day I had maintained myself in a state of torture. I looked about and saw none other than beautiful Princess Rosalind coming towards me, such a welcome sight. All those years we'd been together in the Sultan's land. She was buxom as she'd been then, with glowing skin and huge breasts, and the most noble of faces. Her gown was a deep rose color and her slippers were silver. I stood to greet her.
"You are tired, Dimitri, truly tired, tired from your journey and all you've seen."
Behind me the slaves struggled on, pounding the beaten earth of the bridal path. I could hear the eager cries of the mistresses driving them.
"Your raven hair is as thick as ever, darling," I said.
I crushed Rosalind to me. My chest was burning, my nipples pulsing, and when I felt the crush of her breasts, I felt my cock take over.
"Precious one," I said,
drawing back carefully and looking into her large, always mournful blue eyes. "Would the king and queen take it amiss
if I slipped away now to my rooms.
Not at all, Dmitri,
she said. I've been sent to tell you so expressly. The Queen is worried. You are white as those flowers there.
Let me take you back myself.
Before we ever reached the castle, we were kissing and fondling one another coyly, and I was licking at her ears. I had always loved her small ears. Ears always make me think of seashells. In the Sultanate, my ears had been fitted with gold rings, like many other slaves, and sometimes stuffed with fresh flowers. When that was done, the world became a blur of sounds, as if my sight had somehow been affected, as well as my hearing. We stopped more than once to observe the activities going on in the garden. On a large, grassy court, we found an eager crowd surrounding girl slaves playing at a ball game with knees and elbows, their hands bound behind their backs. The girls were delightfully adorned, one team burnished with gold pigment and the other with silver, hair pinned up to reveal tender necks.
"Don't ask what happens to the losing team," Rosalind said, laughing gaily. "But then don't ask what happens to the winning team either."
The hunt in the maze was taking place as we passed by, and I could see the torches flickering through the shrubbery and hear the excited voices. "I failed at that one always," I confided.
"I'm surprised," said Rosalind, stroking my hair tenderly. "I rather enjoyed it. They really had a challenge hunting me down. I knew just where to hide and how to outsmart them. I emerged the victor more than once."
Victors were celebrated and then rewarded by being chosen for more hunts. I shook my head. All I could remember was the blast of the trumpet telling me to flee, and then crawling desperately through one long corridor of shrubbery after another, until they found me and forced me up with loud cries to be punished with all the other quarry who hadn't provided good sport. It was held in the afternoons then, mostly, not by torchlight, and the Queen had scolded me endlessly for being such an utter disappointment. Again, the sheer size of the garden was astonishing to me. The torches and lanterns were dazzling me as we moved along, and many different threads of music blended in a low, rushing noise, rather like the sound of the fountains we passed. Truly, the festivities seemed to go on forever, and all the courtiers I observed seemed utterly at home in it, familiar with its pastimes, and busy, and not dazed as I was at all. "And this is every night?" I asked.
"For now," said Rosalind, "with so many guests and so many returning. Remember Prince Gerard, the blonde one, not the dark-haired one, the blonde pony who was in the village stables with you, the one always mourning back then for Laurent? Well, he's just returned. The king was so glad to see him, and Gareth, one of the old grooms adored by the king during his time in the stables, has just returned also to help with the king's steeds. Have you seen the royal stables? I must take you around tomorrow."
"Yes, there's so much to see. But I want—"
I didn't have to finish. She kissed me full on the mouth and guided me through the castle doors. We went up the stairs, stopping briefly on each landing to embrace. I reached up under her heavy skirts and felt her ripe, warm sex, always such a delightful shock under all the silk and velvet. At last, we were in my quarters. Maybe the two obedient night slaves were disappointed when called to unlace Princess Rosalind's gown. I hardly cared. They obeyed at once, releasing her from her bindings and lacings, and now I could clutch her immense breasts the way I wanted to do it, and bury my face in them as I nestled them together. We fell under the covers, like people of the great world beyond might do, and she crouched above me as I suckled her nipples hungrily. I loved the sight of them dangling over my face like delicious fruit from a bough.
"You don't want to take off your shirt?"
she asked.
"It's so heavy."
"No," I said. "I prefer it this way, if you'll forgive me."
Of course, my leggings and tunic were gone, and my sex was poking at her greedily. But she wanted to tease me just a little more. She turned suddenly to the slaves who had retreated to the fireplace.
"Good little girl. Bring me a blindfold," she said. "Silk. See-through. Now."
I laughed.
"Hush, prince,"
she said teasingly.
"Each cock is a story unto itself, and yours is gorgeous. Oh, how I hungered for it in the Sultanate. And they were always so strict with us,
so cruel in never allowing us to touch one another or ourselves. Seems we managed, now and then, I said. The blindfold was a pretty gold thing, and she tied it around my eyes. Indeed, I could see through it, but it made the world a dreamlike, magical place, and my excitement grew even more painful and sharp. I'd worn such blindfolds many a time. I marveled at the sense of release that accompanied the wearing of them, the new level of abandon. But the story my cock was telling me was one of agony.
"Stand up, Prince,"
she said in my ear, jumping off the bed suddenly and stretching her long legs and arms. This I could make out in the golden haze that had become the room. Then she pulled her dark hair down out of its combs and let it fall behind her like a great shadow.
"Lovely,"
I whispered. I reached for her voluptuous arms.
"Now I'm going to mount you and ride you," she said. "I'll come and fall to the floor. We shall see."
She jumped up and onto my cock slipping into her, and her sex clamping down on it with the tenacity of the most eager pleasure slave. At last, I almost wept as I stabbed her in a series of jerking spasms.
"Not so fast, beautiful prince," she said. "Now walk. Walk around the bed carrying me."
She wrapped her legs around my hips and her arms around my neck. She was kissing me. I didn't make it 5 steps. After that, it was a bit slower. Her hips and bottom were so voluptuous, and even her calves were soft and tender to the touch. I spread her apart like a peach sliced in half and gazed at the dark pit of her sex for the longest time, the dark purplish lips, the gleaming clitoris. For the 3rd time, we were on the carpet. She begged me to remove my shirt, but I wouldn't. I forced her over and up on her hands and knees and rode her now, my cock inside her, forcing her forward on her path. When she started to come, my hands found the little slippery clitoris and I pinched it and stroked it as I spent into her from the rear and felt her spend as she cried out. All the day's torment and agonies and delicious surprises and tantalizing memories had heated everything I felt for her. And then there was the familiarity of her. After all those years together, this succulent wench whom I'd never been allowed to touch. 1 hour later, I woke to the stillness of the room. The night slaves were still as statues in their positions by the hearth. Rosalind was gone. Fabian had gone to his closet a long time back. But at some point, he had set out my writing things, as he knew I would want. A lamp burned on the table. Dim sounds came to me as if from throughout the castle, dim vibrations and hints of scraping music, and even bits and pieces of song. I got up, and turning my back to the night slaves, who were dozing anyway, stripped off my tunic and shirt, and put on my dressing gown, lacing it at the neck and tying the sash. I was pleasantly exhausted, but my mind was as feverish as it had been all the long day. At the table I sat down, smelled the black ink, and then dipped my quill pen. There was a fresh little bound book before me, the kind I had made for my private thoughts. It was thick, but not too thick, the parchment good quality, and covers made of soft leather engraved with the letter D. I began to write, but I found I'd seen and felt and thought so much that I could only list things, list items and people and moments and places, and so, finally, this was all that I did. When next I fell on the pillow, I slept like the dead. 7. By noon I was in my townhouse, and what a pleasant affair it was. Like all village townhouses, it was more a work of wood than stone, and its buffed and gleaming floors and stairs and railings were its glory, along with its soft painted plaster walls. The tones of peach and yellow and occasional blue were fine for me. The heavy oak furnishings fit for a castle, and by afternoon I had positioned my chair by the high 4th-story window to look down on the open square. No Barbara as yet, but I had been promised she would be delivered soon. By evening, I'd sent my letter to His Majesty begging to speak with him about the place of public punishment, and asking to offer my services, if they should be wanted, as guiding genius, to use his well-chosen words. That night, He came himself to bring me my gold chain and medallion. A messenger came first to say he would shortly arrive. I was again at the window, and the square below was wondrously illuminated, nothing like the shadowy place it had been before. Slaves were being spanked on the turntable, of course, and I could see the maypoles were busy, and people were going in and out of the tents. I thought of many things, many innovations. The ball game with the bent-over painted slaves was fun, but what if the balls were driven at the targets by paddles? I could think of several other variations. Slaves on hands and knees, with heads straight, to receive the circular garlands tossed from a distance by competing lords and ladies. I had been watching it all for hours, and picturing to myself the king coming down from the castle. Did he drive his own chariot, with his finest ponies four abreast? When suddenly, I saw him with his retinue below in the square. What a grand figure he was, with his streaming red and gold cloak, striding through the crowds as they broke for him and bowed on all sides. And how he nodded and reached out to clasp hands here and there, and how buoyant and gladsome he looked. I could see it all even from this distance, the fine figure he cut, and I thought, yes, he has the greatness to rule Belavaltan, with his gracious queen at his side. She was not with him, no, but her devotion to him had been obvious when I'd seen them last night. She had a shyness about her, a shrinking quality. She'd had that when she was a slave. But he was immense, immense in stature and also in spirit. I had never had such a strong sense of it as I did now, watching him receive the admiration of so many eyes and the humble respect of so many hands as he made his way right towards my house. He didn't remain with me for long. I received him in my new parlour, which must have looked quaint and small and confining to him. Had he ever resided or even stayed in such a place? He stood the whole while with his secretary, Emlyn, and his attendants behind him, a giant beneath the low ceiling. He put the chain about my neck. "You are now the master of the place of public punishment," he said. He embraced me and kissed me. He was perhaps the tallest man I knew. "I'm glad you've returned, Dimitri," he said. "Now I'm told that Lexius will return soon. I am so curious to see him." "Is this truly so, sire?" I asked. "Lexius, here. Lexius coming all the way from India, from his own realm. A letter arrived from him late today," said the king. "He's on the continent. He's not far away." I felt my heart beating. I wondered if the king could sense it. It seemed loud enough for all the world to hear. "Alexei has promised to tell me what happened between Lexius and the late queen," said Laurent. "I don't mean to press for unpleasant stories, and I will make no judgments, of course, but I do so want to know." I felt the blood rush to my face, though this shouldn't have been happening. That old tale was simple enough. It was the mysteries of... But then I didn't let myself think on it again, only telling myself I will soon see Lexius. Lexius has actually been lured by the new Belavaltan. What can this mean? "Come dine with us, Dimitri," said the king as he left the room, "whenever you like. And now I have gifts for you." He snapped his fingers, and through the front door, three naked slaves were delivered by two of the predictably comely grooms in court livery. There stood Barbara, trembling magnificently, of course, and lovely Kira of the blonde braids, who'd been provided for me in my chambers, and handsome, fetching Bertram. At once the trio fell on their knees and rushed to kiss my slippers. A delicious perfume filled the air. "Sire, thank you," I said at once. "I'm speechless, truly."
"Enjoy them, prince," said Laurent. "And remember, here in the village you can pack them off to the slaves' hall at any time for their bath, oiling and sleep, and send for them at your leisure. No need to service them here under your roof, unless you prefer it."
His voice was easy and casual. "These grooms are two of the best, and they'll be with you until you dismiss them. They're artists at working slaves, putting them through their paces, if you're of a mind to watch, and will obey your every command. And, prince, your grooms may all wear the court's livery if you like, as you are a member of the court, not the village livery." "Thank you, sire," I said. And there's the place of public punishment right outside your door, of course. Now, I cannot vouch for the particular virtues of this delectable little sweetheart, Barbara, but I can assure you that Kira and Bertram have met my most exacting standards for performance. Once more, we embraced, and then he left me. It seemed a great, brilliant light had gone out of the little parlor once he was gone. I stood stranded on the polished floor, staring back into the past, into the dark, narrow face of Lexius, into his black eyes. I smelled the hot air of another place. I heard the songs of the jungle in my ears, saw ancient walls covered with dancing, naked figures, gods and goddesses of another land. The grooms stood waiting, and the three slaves knelt at my feet, at my mercy. Ah, such breasts, such luscious breasts, and the cock on Bertram. "What would you like to do now, my lord?" asked Fabian. For a long moment, I said nothing. Then I heard myself speaking. "Welcome to my house, lovelies. I shall take my time enjoying you one by one as suits my pace. And you, gentlemen," I said to the grooms, "one of you is to spank Kira and Bertram over the knee now and put them beside this little fireplace, as I saw them positioned in the great castle, until I send for them. The other, attend on me." Without further explanation, I bid Barbara to rise. Then I picked her up with both hands and pitched her over my right shoulder. I caught her ankles firmly as she cried out, and I carried her up the staircase in this way until I reached the bedchamber. I laid her down on the bed. She shivered and dared not look at me, glancing up at the polished mahogany of the ceiling of the bed, and then closing her eyes. Quickly, desperately, she put her hands behind her neck. I pushed her naked legs wide apart. I inspected her delicate little gaping sex, the dark wrinkled pink lips peeping through the glistening black hair, and the curve of her little bottom, making me think of a fruit cut in half, with its core exposed, as women's upturned privates often did. Dark, mysterious, the kernel of so many secrets. I had thought of a peach last night when inspecting Rosalind in this same way. Barbara let out a little scream as I buried my face in her pubic hair. I pressed my tongue into her, tasting her delicious, smoking and fragrant juices. I lapped at her juices. Her hips rode up and down helplessly under me. With my mouth over her clitoris, over her gasping sex, I knew she had no control, no control whatsoever, and I stabbed at her clitoris with my tongue until she came without stinting. On and on she came, abandoned to the pleasure, helpless in the grip of it. Delirious torture for me, but that's what I wanted. I seated myself on the bed and brought her hips up onto my lap, again studying her sex, smoothing the hair with my hand, parting her legs and prying open the lips. She shuddered and wept, but her hips rocked. She couldn't control them. I pondered the mystery of her gleaming wet sex, the mystery of these little lips, and this curious opening, this secret little chamber in which pleasure raged as surely as it raged in my cock. "You have so much to learn," I said, "but you're beautiful to me, precious to me. And you're my first acquisition, my first slave, my first chosen one."
"My lord," she wept softly, "deliver me to your pleasure. Only show me what it is you want of me."
I flipped her over on her face on the coverlet. Her skin was petal perfect and so smooth to the touch, so sweet. Her little bottom was made up of the most shapely little mounds. "Is there anyone there?" I called out.
"Yes, Prince," came a voice. "Keenan, Prince, here to serve you."
"Her little anus is too tender for my cock," I said to Keenan. "What toys do we have under this roof, if any? What emollients?"
"Right here, Prince," he said.
He stepped to the side of the bed with a large, shallow casket, holding open the lid.
"These are wax, Prince, these little plugs and phalluses. The Queen designed these, and Lady Eva has them made. After you use them, they will be melted down for new ones."
"Excellent," I said, gazing over the selection. "This is exactly what I wanted." I selected a small butt plug with a gentle head, flared at the bottom, and with a place in the base to insert flowers or feathers, of which the casket had a little heap. That one, and fit it with the red feathers. At once, Keenan prepared it for me. He held open the jar of rich rose-coloured cream. Lovely scent. I smoothed the cream over the plug, and then, slipping my left hand under Barbara's tender belly, I lifted her. She moaned. I slipped the well-lubricated butt plug into her. She looked so fetching with the little feathers coming out of her hind end, and so helpless as she lay against the palm of my left hand. "Now, I think you'll ride me about the room, the way a certain lady did last night," I said. I climbed to my feet and brought her up to stand on hers, and then I lifted her and pushed her down on my hard cock. I went weak with the shock of it, of her hot, slippery sex enclosing me. Without being told, she wrapped her legs about me as Rosalind had done, and her arms too, because she had to. I felt her little head tumble onto my shoulder, and smelled the lovely perfume of her hair. I walked to the window, with her firmly clasped to my cock, and looked down on the place of public punishment. I saw the row of pillories where I had found her. Then I turned and thrust into her hard, and felt her bounce on me wildly, with an abandon that dimmed the memory of my sweet Rosalind. When I spent, she went rigid, gasping, and then coming, carrying me past the peak, until I could bear it no more. I lifted her off and held her in my arms, a bundle of the softest, warmest limbs against me. "You are the tastiest of repasts, my sweet," I crooned in her ear, "and just look at your shining little bottom, all white and fresh, peeled from the turntable. So tender."
"Yes, my lord," she whispered.
I smoothed her hair back and told her to look at me. These were the eyes I had remembered. No disappointment there. The intelligence of these eyes. "What do you fear the most now, little partridge?" I asked.
"Whatever pleases you, my lord," she said calmly.
She didn't smile, but I did. "Very clever," I said. I turned and told the groom to lay out a paddle and strap for me. I flung her over the side of the bed face down and told her to spread her arms out and spread her legs wide, wide, until she couldn't spread them any further. She obeyed until both legs were wobbling, shaking wildly. The little red feathers coming out of her anus would be easy to avoid. I took the belt in my hands, very smooth gilded leather, and doubled on a hook, perhaps 3 feet wide. It wouldn't cut her, no, and it would not bruise her easily either. And then, in a fury, I began to spank her with it, spank her hard and fast, careful not to strike the feathered butt plug, until she screamed and sought to muffle her scream in the covers. I kept on spanking her, harder and faster, until she was undulating madly under the blows, twisting and turning feverishly, her little feet rising, then falling back down to the carpet. I didn't let up. I spanked her over and over and over again. I loved the sound of it, the sight of the broad leather smacking her reddening skin, her sweet, tender skin. I smacked the tender underside of her bottom until it was too red, and I had to spread the blows. A great exhilaration came over me, and on I worked on her tender, high calves, and her soft, pale thighs, and then back again on the top of her little bottom, spanking her till she was all the color of a red rose garden. Finally, I stopped. My arm was tired. I was in a daze, but it was a different daze from all those through which I'd passed earlier. I saw my left hand play with her tender red flesh. How hot it was. How delectably hot. I didn't want the butt plug now. I pulled it out of her and threw it to the side. Yes, just her red little backside and her red legs. For a long moment I stood there looking at her. I could hear the sounds from the square below, the rise and fall of a mass of voices as if they were water. And there came to my ears Barbara's soft, sobbing cries, so eloquent of total surrender. The groom made no sound. I went to her and, gathering up her long brown curls, I lifted her gently off the bed by them, catching her chin with my right hand to make her stand upright. She was limp, utterly without any resistance. "My first slave," I whispered, and so she was. She was my very first, and this the very first time I'd possessed a slave utterly, and she could not grasp, perhaps, what it meant to me. I covered her face with wet, eager kisses. I think I was crying. Our tears were mingling. "Barbara," I whispered, "I adore you." I wanted to say, "I am you," but I didn't, because she would not have wanted it. "Barbara," I sighed against her ear. I caught the heated perfume of her sex, her sweet little sex. Then she had her trusting arms around my neck again, her silken arms, and I was sliding my cock into her fragrant little cloister, and from the square below came a great roar, as if of applause or triumph.
Chapter 9. Bren, to serve in the realm of the paddle and the strap.
1. I would have gone to Bellavulton without Sybil. I had determined to go from the day I'd copied out the proclamation and read it in the town square. The whole country was talking of King Laurent and Queen Beauty, and that slaves of the new kingdom would be accepted from all ranks and allowed to offer their vow of allegiance for 2 or more years to enjoy the pleasures of naked slavery. My father was secretary to the old duke, and I'd been educated to take his place since I was a small child, to keep the libraries and the archives, and to write letters for the family as was required. Lady Sybil grew up the 5th daughter of the old duke's eldest son, and, with 4 daughters ahead of her, had little hope of a dowry, or even the chance to meet a fine man. She and I ran in the fields together, and played in the castle gardens, and read books together, because nobody much paid attention, with Lady Sybil's mother dead, and my mother busy with 3 more sons. I taught Sybil to read, and then her father obtained a tutor for her,